Hello, my name is Ray Hansen. I want to welcome you to today's webinar event hosted by the Energy Services Coalition. I have the privilege and honor of serving as the president of the Energy Services Coalition, and on behalf of the Board of Directors and the entire membership of the ESC, we extend our gratitude to all who have elected to participate in this webinar event, with particular gratitude expressed to Karen Keeler, Joseph McLinney, Darren Lauder, and Peter Flynn, our speakers for today. To ensure that your webinar experience is highly satisfactory, let's begin first by addressing a few technical guidelines. On the next slide, you will note that if you encounter any problems, that there's an alternative way to view the slides. You can go to the Energy Services Coalition website, follow the instructions there, and you'll be able to see the contents of today's PowerPoint presentation. For audio problems, you may use your telephone after joining the webinar, and the phone number and access codes are on display on the screen now. For today's webinar support, please contact Linda Smith, her phone number, at 303-582-5198. Hopefully Linda will be able to assist you. We want to take an opportunity to share with you the series of webinars that will be presented by the Energy Services Coalition. This is the second of two, and there will be many more offered this year to help those who participate understand the benefits of performance contracting and how it relates to various aspects of facility improvements and various ways to assist you in your challenges of being energy efficient and improving your buildings. Through the series of webinars, we want you to get to know the Energy Services Coalition better and to learn about all that we offer as an organization and all we do to help end users better understand and more successfully utilize energy savings performance contracting through this webinar series. At the conclusion of today's webinar, we hope you have learned enough about the ESC to want to become involved. There are exciting and fulfilling opportunities within state chapters and on various committees to participate and contribute in meaningful ways to support the ESC mission. ESC is a national nonprofit organization. Our membership is composed of individuals from the public and private sector, and this public-private partnership offers a unique and valuable forum to candidly and openly discuss all aspects of energy savings, performance contracting, for the benefit of all parties involved. Many ESC members are highly experienced professionals representing a great knowledge and resource-rich base of first-hand experience with performance contracting from procurement to implementation to post-implementation validation of savings. The experience and expertise is broad-based, coming from those who have provided as well as those who have made extensive use of energy savings performance contracting as a technical and financial tool to address deferred maintenance, facility and infrastructure improvements, and to incorporate green, renewable, and sustainability in their performance contracting projects. After the webinar for today is hosted by the Education Committee, which is a subcommittee of the National ESC Board of Directors. And if you have any questions following today's event, you can contact Rhonda Courtney, at 615-885-0019, and she'll be glad to give you more information. I want next to introduce our first speaker for today. We're going to be hearing first from Karen Keeler, who is the Senior Vice President with AAIG in Denver. Karen is focused on the financing of energy performance contracting, and she has been active in the financial industry for over 15 years and has been responsible for the successful origination of over $1 billion in lease financings supporting energy efficiency projects. In addition, Karen has been involved in the development of performance contracting legislation in several states and is an active member of NASCO and the Energy Services Coalition. And we're very pleased to have her with us today. Karen, we look forward to hearing your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray, and thank you for this opportunity to speak to the membership and other interested parties about what the current economic climate is and what the current trends are for financing of energy performance contracts. I'm looking forward to speaking to you today in regard to lease purchase financing, which historically has been one of the easiest and most accessible vehicles to finance energy performance contracts nationally. And I was asked to speak just briefly to those in the audience who aren't familiar with the initiation or the origination of energy performance contracts as to what they are and how lease purchase financing ties in with energy performance contracting. Energy performance contracting dates back to the initial idea of bundling up a bunch of energy efficiency improvement measures and capital improvement projects and finding an affordable solution that would allow customers to be able to make the upgrades they need now in the new infrastructure with no upfront capital costs, paying for the measures later through energy savings that result from the project, and by being able to benefit immediately from getting not only the new equipment, but the expertise from energy service professionals through ongoing maintenance services, and being able to accomplish many projects at once, where the savings as a result of the installation will pay for the project over time, as well as for the service contract tied to the energy performance contract. As time has gone on, we have perfected, in our opinion in the industry, how lease purchase financing can dovetail into energy performance contracting by providing a flexible financing tool that has the ability not only to provide direct support to a performance contract, but also take advantage of other financing sources, if you will, other capital sources, and dovetailing them into the financing so that you're not limited with just the lease purchase, but can also leverage other capital resources and bring them in to finance a larger project than you might otherwise be able to do through just a traditional lease purchase. So the most positive thing about lease purchase finance, other than the fact that it provides for 100% of the financing, is that there is no negative impact on cash flow because we're able to backload the payments or structure the payments for the project by taking the energy savings and making sure that the payments in each year going forward through the finance term are covered by the savings that are produced by the project. This is different than bond financings and other types of financings, and we're really looking to the energy services company guarantee to provide 100% debt service coverage. This all being said, as some background, I want to speak to how we're looking at these energy performance contracts in the current market and how we in the lending industry have altered in some respects in the current climate how we underwrite these transactions. Energy performance contracts have always been viewed as self-supported debt because of the virtue of the fact that we're looking for the savings to cover the debt service of the project as opposed to increased budget dollars. In addition to being project neutral, we have been looking to the fact that the savings, because of the guarantee, ease our reliance at looking at the overlying, you know, ability of the municipality to raise additional capital dollars. In the current climate, because so many municipalities have cut budgets, there has been an increased need to underwrite the credit of the municipality based on the cuts. And therefore, although energy performance contracts are actually very attractive, we're finding ourselves doing a lot more due diligence on the ESCO, providing the savings guarantee, in addition to our underwriting of the municipality. And how that's impacting the industry is it's taking a longer period of time to underwrite these transactions because depending on where you are geographically in the United States, you have different factors that are coming into play with the budget process. Fewer institutions are willing to lend outside of areas that they're geographically familiar with, so they are pulling back. So we're seeing fewer players in the market nationally willing to go out and compete for the financing of these deals. The impact of this has been that as there's been less capital and more projects, the interest rates have gone up. The impact on that to the energy services companies is obviously that it's impacting the ability to increase margins in the same manner as in prior years. You used to have 10 or 15 of us chasing a transaction, and now there may only be 3 or 4, you know, finance institutions willing to bid based on where the project is, what the amount of the project is, who the energy services company is, and where the project is located geographically. This has put back onto the ESCO the requirement that maybe was a little lax in prior years of doing increased due diligence at the front end when they're qualifying a project. what we're recommending is, just as you would pre-qualify a project from the engineering standpoint and whether or not it makes sense for you to go through a detailed audit, we're also asking that you pre-qualify the project from a credit standpoint with lenders that are in the area who might be willing to step up and finance the project. Where we were out 15 and 20 years previously on projects, there's been a real pullback in the industry to where now the maximum term by general guidelines is 15 years. The energy services industry is having to adjust to this, and that means in many instances having to pull back measures that are included in projects or tailor them more specifically so that they'll fit the parameters of what's available in the capital markets to finance the project. It's become very competitive as far as interest rates. I will tell you that I think that with the interest rate market going up, it's going to be more and more difficult for a lender to lock in an interest rate for over 30 days. I think that, you know, given the timelines that it takes for these projects to come together, it makes sense to cushion those interest rates at the front end and continue talking to whoever the lender is that you're anticipating partnering with on a lease purchase to make sure that the interest rates are still valid as you work through the details of your project, and also to make sure that the credit quality is staying where you anticipate it being. As a very good current example, yesterday there was an article that came out about a certain county in Alabama that is looking at a default situation on some bonds. If there were deals going on prior to yesterday in that region, no one would have known that this issue would now impact all lending in that area. So it's important for the energy services companies not only to remain aware of what's going on with their project and with the interest rate market, but also issues and things going on in the geographic region where they're trying to accomplish the deals that might impact the credit going forward. Lenders throughout the United States, and I'm sure this comes as a surprise to anyone, are trying to raise capital. This means they're willing to go out for shorter terms. They want higher interest rates. But in addition to that, they're also taking a look at how much money they have out, specifically on projects involving certain municipalities and also certain ESCOs. So before moving forward on projects, you want to be sure that you've pre-qualified that there won't be a problem for you on the particular transaction based on, you know, the size and the term. The good news in all of this is that there is still capital available and increased interest in performance contracting based on the fact that it is budget neutral and based upon the fact that the savings for the project do help pay for it. It is a result of the federal government support and the stimulus funding being made available. There is a heightened interest throughout the industry in these projects. I think the trick is going to be how to dovetail the benefit of stimulus money into projects and use that as an incentive for lenders to get involved in these projects. As far as, and we might want to move forward to the next slide, or no, you've already forwarded, I apologize, my computer's behind yours. A lot of the reasons currently that we're having challenges raising capital is because we're looking to the project and the savings in those projects to cover the full cost of the transaction. One of the alternatives is to start leveraging capital resources other than just borrowing 100% to ease the weight on savings. It's a lot easier if you can find other capital dollars to apply as a down payment to support a shorter term than to try to find savings to increase a shorter term. One of the things that we go back to are the traditional sources of alternative capital for these projects besides budget dollars, because many of these customers are not going to have additional capital. What they are going to be able to do, however, is apply for grants, use incentive monies as seed money. Instead of using federal stimulus money as the sole source for a transaction, it makes a lot of sense to try to dovetail it into a financing tool like a lease purchase. You can use the money as a down payment and leverage it with other sources of capital, such as state grants, such as bonds, such as tax credits, in order to build the project and not have the full reliance for debt service to come from the debt savings of the total project cost, but also to have it be applicable to the to the down payment of the project. There is an example up on the screen at the moment where we have basically recently done a transaction in Oregon with a college where the project size was $17 million. The savings, however, were only sufficient to cover about $13 million. The difference between that $17 million and the $13 million was made up through a tax credit that was received through the state and money through the state energy fund through a specific grant program. By applying the $4 million in credits, we were able to reduce the project size to where the customer did not have to give up any of the crucial elements of the project. Rather, they were able to find alternative sources of capital to contribute and use to leverage so they could keep the project at the same amount. I think the important thing to think about in the current time is not just how can we go out and find a lease purchase to finance a 15-year job or a 20-year job, but how to go out and combine sources of capital together to leverage so that you can reduce the project size, shorten the term, so that it fits into more of what the capital markets have available for funding in this time. I think tax credits are a wonderful, you know, way to invest, as are the state energy program funds that are coming available through the stimulus funding package. There are many traditional sources through the education department and other departments throughout the United States in different states. And by taking advantage of different utility incentives and operating incentives that are available, we can reduce the reliance on the lease purchase to carry the program or the savings to carry the program, which has pushed these terms out to 15 and 20 years. I want to thank everyone for the opportunity to speak today. There are several case studies that are available. I think there are two presented, the second one being, you know, a reflection of the stimulus money impact. The one thing I would encourage is that we have a limitation when we do apply stimulus money. If you are going through the state program where the State Office of Energy is dispersing the funds, prior to putting a project together, you must complete the application process and be approved for the funding before you move forward with the project with the lender. And I just wanted to mention that because it is coming up on several transactions. We were successful in Texas at being able to bring the money all together because they didn't have the funds available and bring it in. But at that point in time, it was pointed out that if we had moved forward on the project and then tried to reimburse later, that the capital would not have been available. I want to thank everyone again for this opportunity, and I'd like to introduce for the next project segment Joey McLinney, who is president of McLinney and Company. He's going to speak on bonds and the ability for you all to increase your project sizes by decreasing your interest rates. I understand he has been doing this for over 20 years, and I look forward to hearing what he has to say. Thank you again for your time.
Karen, that was great. Thank you very much. This is Joey McLinney, and I am with McLinney & Company in Kansas City. I'm going to be talking about clean renewable energy bonds, qualified zone academy bonds, and qualified school construction bonds. I'm going to focus and take up the majority of my time on qualified zone academy bonds because, one, they are the most prevalent in the industry right now. They've been around the longest. And because clean renewable energy bonds are CREBs, and qualified school construction bonds, or QSCABs, have been patterned after qualified zone academy bonds. First, the clean renewable energy bond, and this is a perfect, Karen provided a perfect lead-in to this conversation because qualified zone academy bonds, clean renewable energy bonds, and QSCABs, qualified school construction bonds, are taxable tax credit bonds. And if you could back up just one slide before we move on to the steps. The clean renewable energy bonds, as I mentioned, all of these provide a taxable tax credit to the investor. What that means to the borrower and to the ESCO is that instead of an interest check being sent to the investor by the school district or the municipality, they receive a federal tax credit from the U.S. government. And in effect, it takes the borrowing from 5% for 15 years, in some cases, to 0%. In addition, there are ways that you can actually have a negative interest rate for the school district or for a municipality. Beginning with clean renewable energy bonds, the criteria for a clean renewable energy bond, and these have all been changed. I'll back up for just a moment. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, ARRA, or ARRR, as it's lovingly known, has expanded all three of these programs. Clean renewable energy bonds went from $750 million to $2.4 billion. QDEBs went from $400 million to $1.4 billion. This is nationwide. And qualified school construction bonds, or QSCABs, went to $6.6 billion. So there are, and each state, excluding CREBs, clean renewable energy bonds, each state has an allocation. Now, clean renewable energy bonds, the criteria is the project must be clean and it must generate electricity. Those are the two hurdles. It's probably my least favorite because you must apply to the Treasury Department, and in my opinion, it's too much of a time lag between the time you apply and the time you move your project forward. In addition, on all three programs, the federal government has increased the tax credit that the investor receives. Unfortunately, on the clean renewable energy bonds, they increased it 200 basis points or two percentage points interest rate-wise, but then they decreased the amount that you can actually claim. So quite literally, they took it from a 6 to an 8% taxable, and then all of a sudden they said, but of that 8%, you're only allowed to take 70% of it. So they took a good idea, and they've messed up with it a little bit. Now, the clean renewable energy bond is available to any municipal borrower. Now, we're going to focus on the Qualified Zone Academy bond because, A, it is the most prevalent in the industry, and almost every state has an allocation and has used these projects successfully with a few exceptions. Now, the steps involved in a Qualified Zone Academy bond, you must, first of all, qualify, and almost every school in the country qualifies. It requires 35% free and reduced student body, the Free and Reduced Lunch Act. And you can qualify by individual schools within a school district. It's been my experience over the last 10 years that almost every school has at least a few schools that can qualify. A zone academy has to be created. This is a simple process and can be done by a resolution. You need a zone academy plan, and the bar is not set very high by the Treasury or the government on what a zone academy plan is. It's basically made up of three things. Your zone academy plan must be designed to increase graduation rates, increase employment rates, and better prepare students for the ever-increasingly complex workforce of the 21st century. Those pretty much are what every school teacher every day tries to do when they walk into a classroom. So it's not very difficult to adapt current curriculum to fit this type of program. I've seen schools that have really run with this and taken this program and moved it from something that's a simple adaptation to creating actual technology academies or individual academies that fit beautifully. What used to be the most difficult part about a QSAB is that each project required a outside 10% matching contributor. This 10% matching contributor, almost all of the time, is an in-kind contribution, and that's fine. We've found these for more than 350 schools. So while it seems like it might be an onerous task and a lot of school districts balk at that step, it requires a little bit more than smiling and dialing, but that's about the extent of it. Now, with the QDAB and the QSCAB, the best benefit to the program is that you receive your allocation, which is simply permission, from the state departments of education. You do not have to go to the federal government. Each state department of education has a program. Almost all of them have a very simple application process. You apply, they turn around, give you an allocation for the amount that you've issued. Some states have caps on what you can ask for. Once you receive permission, you must go out and find a qualified buyer. Most of these have been insurance companies or banks. This now is probably the biggest challenge, because a qualified buyer, typically a bank, received a tax credit instead of an interest check. Well, as you probably are all aware, banks have had a little bit of trouble making a profit. They have a great deal of losses on their books that can be carried forward. Well, if you have a carried forward loss, that's identical to a tax credit. So it really is finding the proper buyers has become the biggest challenge with all QSETs at this point. Now, we are still getting them done. As Karen said, these are there is capital in the market searching for lending. Now, the next QSCADs were designed after QSETs, and next slide would be great. The beauty of the QSCAD is that it eliminated all of the pain except the qualified buyer from the QSAT program. No longer do you need a Zone Academy plan. No longer do you need a Zone Academy. No longer do you need to find the 10% match. Each state receives an allocation. Each qualified borrower, you don't need to be at 35% either. So you can go to your state, you can ask for an allocation, you'll receive your allocation, and then you'll go out and find your qualified buyer. These bonds are not very difficult to get authorization for. The most difficult part, as I said, is finding a qualified buyer. Now, the biggest reason that anybody should consider going through any of these processes, especially the QSAB and the QSCAB, is that it takes your project from an interest-bearing borrowing to interest-free borrowing. And what that means over a 15-year period is an increase of at least 30% in the project size, or a decrease because it decreases your interest cost over a 15-year period by at least 30%. So your profits can increase by 30%, the project size can increase by 30%, or basically you can get a great deal more bang for your buck. Now, taxcreditbonds.org lists several of these projects and has a great deal of information on that, and Wikipedia, you can do pretty good searches through that. So that's pretty much what a QSAB, QSCAB, and a clean renewable energy bond are. They provide tax subsidies to your borrowers, interest rate subsidies to your borrowers through tax credits. And it's a dynamite program. It should be used with and has been used by the largest ESCOs in the country, and they're using them to multiply or increase the size of their projects. They're also using them to open the door to other projects, because if you can borrow without having to pay interest, all of a sudden you are borrowing as if you are paying cash, even though it's over a 15-year period. So they are I've never found an ESCO project, an energy savings project, that does not fit under either under the clean renewable energy bond project, if it's creating electricity, clean qualified zone academy bond, and qualified school construction bond. So they are dynamite programs, and they should be considered. Next slide, please. So thank you very much. This was a picture of me trying to get into my school after my graduate school, and I'd like to introduce the next person, who is Darren Lauder. Darren is with the law firm of Ballard & Spars. They focus on energy project finance and related real estate issues. Darren has worked with utilities, energy project developers, tax equity investors, and a whole slew of other energy and project financing on the legal side. He's also advised clients on multiple financing and regulatory issues, including emergency state federal renewable and carbon regulatory regimes, which is what I'm most interested in on this next slide. So, Darren, take it away, please.
Thank you, Joey. In fact, both Karen and Joey have laid down a lot of the fundamentals and the groundwork for the topics that I'll be covering. I'll be addressing how qualified energy conservation bonds can get into energy efficiency projects, how the energy efficiency conservation block grants tie into that, and how the new markets tax credits in eligible locations may also be able to work into a project. I should point out before I go into the specific programs that there are a number of efforts on the state level in most cases for things like sustainable energy utilities that are focused on combining multiple sources, such as those that have been discussed already and those that will be discussed, through things like a sustainable energy utility in the state of Delaware, for example. They have one of those. That's beyond the scope of what we're addressing today, but I just wanted to put that into context, that there are programs that are focused on broadening and incorporating multiple tools to simplify this process for both the public customers as well as the energy services company. So the first program, the Qualified Energy Conservation Bonds, are actually very similar to the Clean Renewable Energy Bonds in their structure. Joey mentioned, there have been a number of changes in the amount of the credit you're able to take, but also in the credit quality that's used as a benchmark for the rate, and some tweaks to the rules for money that can be kept in the accounts for sinking fund payments that ends up resulting in pretty low interest rates. And the folks that I've talked to still believe that these bonds, this is another example of a tax credit bond where the holder of the bond receives a tax credit in lieu of interest so that the borrower can pay very low interest. The folks I've talked to still think that these bonds should be approaching 0% for about a 15-year bond. So all of those benefits that Joey mentioned on the projects should still be possible. The stimulus bill authorized $3.2 billion in qualified energy conservation bonds. These bonds were just created in the fall with an $800 million allocation, so this was a very large expansion. Although they may only be issued by state and local governments, they may be used, the proceeds may be used for a number of purposes, which includes some grants to private entities. So it is possible whether or not the public body is a customer of an energy efficiency project, it's possible that those funds could be make their way into a private project as well. There has been some guidance issued, this is not an application in the sense of a competitive application. This is based on population through the states. And on the next slide, you'll see a list of the allocations. Some of the top states have very large allocations. Perfect. Some of the smaller states have allocation amounts that make it difficult for these bonds to be used on more than a one or two pilot projects. But some of the larger states, California with an allocation of $381 million, for example, could support a number of projects. And there is a sub-allocation in which the larger cities and counties receive a direct allocation, so they don't have to work through the state political process to obtain their allocation. And I know from some of the clients that we've worked with that people are certainly looking at these for energy efficiency programs and projects as they look at how to either buy down or use the financing. I think this results for the cities that do that, cities or counties that do that, this results in a challenge of the energy services companies being in a position of kind of emphasizing the value add that they bring to the projects. Once a municipality realizes that they could obtain their own financing, I know some of them have asked the question as to why they don't do more of this themselves. So I think there's a challenge there with the energy services companies to help them answer that question as to what technical specialty the ESCOs bring to the process, for example. On the energy efficiency grant side, there are a number of grants that are available under the recent stimulus bill. As Karen noted, these funds can be used as down payments or buy-downs on the prices of projects. There are funds for the Weatherization Assistance Program for low-income families under state offices. That's typically for residential or multifamily projects. There's also some funding for federal building improvements, which would include and could include energy efficiency projects. Again, those are going to go through the federal spending channels. And then there's some smaller grants amounts for housing projects. The Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Program, however, is probably the more immediately useful program. there's over $2.7 billion in direct formula energy efficiency conservation block grants that are available. Those are not competitive. Those are available to directly to larger cities and towns. Either, as you can see here, there's a population threshold in both cases, or the 10 largest cities or counties in each state. The next slide, please. There is a smaller portion of competitive grants, and the deadline for the Conservation Block Grant Program is June 25th, 2009, so it's coming up very quickly. And again, I know we've worked with some public bodies in as they've looked at these grants, and they're looking to get some specific project sites. It's very much an implementation and shovel-ready kind of emphasis. But the fact that these are directly available to the cities, counties in a state make them very attractive for being able to be used for energy efficiency projects. As you can see on the next slide, the eligible activities, it's actually very broad. The number of categories and the types of uses are very flexible and can be used in a lot of different areas related to energy efficiency. So it's either directly or indirectly. You can see grants to nonprofit organizations for energy efficiency retrofits is one that's kind of an umbrella that could be used in some pretty flexible ways. And I would like to point out, going back to the first topic of the energy conservation bond, that these block grants can be combined with financing tools like the qualified energy conservation bonds to help leverage those grant funds into larger projects or into more cost-effective projects. And finally, on the grant side, just the energy program grants to the state energy offices, those are going to be very different in each state. A lot of variability, a lot of flexibility, but each state has very specific criteria and specific emphasis as to how they're going to apply that program. I'd like to turn for a few minutes on the federal new markets tax credits. This is not often thought of as an energy or an energy efficiency tax credit, and strictly speaking, it's not, but it's also a very flexible tax credit that can be used for a wide variety of projects and programs as long as those programs or projects are located in eligible census tracts. Essentially, that includes lower-income census tracts, but it often includes downtown areas that you wouldn't immediately think of as low-income. In one case, a mid-sized city, their convention center, for example, was located in such an area, and an energy efficiency project within that convention center, or in case we were looking at a solar energy project, would qualify for participation in this program. The way it works, and this is to encourage private capital investment in low-income communities, so it works through a grant, a credit that's received by investors into an investment fund. It's kind of an indirect way for the tax to get in, but it results in very low-cost financing. Get the next slide, please. Actually, next two slides, probably. The way this works, it's a little bit complicated, the structure, but if you think of it in essence as kind of a black box, the result of that black box is very cheap financing. Again, this has had a very large increase in the last 2 years, both last year's allocation and this year's, have been increased to $5 billion. Just last week, they announced the $1.5 billion allocation, additional allocation for last year's applicants, which was made retroactively. And they have not yet allocated the $5 billion for this year. There are likely to be a lot of people with allocations under this program that would be able to use those allocations for energy efficiency projects. Next slide is the New Markets Tax Credit Investor. And again, this is not necessarily where an energy services company would come into the project, but this is what drives the returns on the project, that there's a tax credit equal to 39% of the investment, and that can be leveraged. So and taken over a 7-year period. What that results in, that 7-year period where the tax investor needs to allocate those funds to projects, typically result in interest only loan repayment during the 7 years. And at the end of the 7 years, the loans are typically refinanced, but a portion of that loan is sometimes forgiven or done in kind of a roundabout way, but it results in loan forgiveness of a portion of the loan. And that they can often be a substantial portion, 10 to 20%, for example. Why don't we move to the CDE, Community Development Entity, is the organization that's essentially the intermediary that allows for the credit and the investment fund money to make its way down to a project in an eligible area. So, for example, if a project located in a downtown area or low-income area, it could be in a public building, it could be in a private building, these entities would be able to organize the tax credit lending. And these are large names. U.S. Bank is typically involved in a lot of the financing. You can see some of the companies here that have set up CDEs, PNC, Wachovia. These are large players involved in this process. The final slide on the what's called a QALICD, which is the Qualifying Active Low-Income Community Business. That business of installing energy efficiency projects or upgrades, for example, could be the qualifying business. And in fact, the tax credit is so flexible it doesn't even have to be a separate entity. It could simply be a separate operating group within a larger company to qualify for this. And essentially the bottom line result for the project is lower rate financing. And this tends to work in combination with lots of other programs. So it's a very flexible way of getting financing. I think that's it on the tax credit pieces. I wanted to thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you today as well and participate in the panel. And wanted to introduce Peter Flynn, who's had lots of experiences in both law and finance in structuring, funding federal, municipal, and commercial energy projects, energy efficiency and renewable projects, as well as all aspects of the partnership process and financing. Graduated from Boston University School of Law, Syracuse, and although his picture's not here, he assures me he's very good looking. So we'll turn the time here over to Peter.
I can hear you, Peter.
Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. I was speaking for a little while, and I guess no one heard me, so I'll start again. Just first of all, thank you to Darren for the introduction and to ESC for including me in the webinar. I will try to, I know we've only got about 10 minutes left here, so I'll try to condense a little bit while still giving you, I think, hopefully some useful information and useful topics to think about. I'm focusing mostly on taxable financing structures. An overview of Build America bonds, and then I'll have a little discussion around alternative financing structures for performance contracting and the benefits of those, I think, in today's market. First of all, in terms of Build America bonds, part of ERA that was signed by the President back on February 17th created two types of tax-advantaged or taxable municipal securities known as Build America bonds or known as BABs. There are essentially those two types are issuer subsidy BABs and investor subsidy BABs. For issuer subsidy BABs, municipal issuers can sell taxable bonds and receive a subsidy directly back from the U.S. Treasury equal to 35% of the interest on those bonds. The flip side of that, the other choice issuers can make is to provide for investor subsidy Build America bonds, where issuers again sell taxable bonds, but in this case the investor receives a tax credit equal to, and in this case it's a tax credit equal to 35% of the interest received. That tax credit is transferable transferable. It's securitizable. So it's somewhat liquid. It's a tough market for tax credits now, but it is liquid. Proceeds of both of those types of issuances, though they're taxable, can only be used for non-private activity government purposes and can only be issued in the years 2009 and 2010. Private activity bonds, including 501c3 debt, are not eligible for Build America bond issuances. And really, one of the keys behind this, in addition to the short time frame for getting these bonds out the door in 2009, 2010, to add to the stimulus effect, is to really significantly expand the investor base for municipal issuers. And ultimately, the hope was, and it has generally resulted in reducing all-in borrowing costs relative to traditional tax-exempt bonds. In the next slide, some of the structuring considerations. The Act provides for significant flexibility with Build America bonds. There are no restrictions on size, amortization, maturity, coupon type, or callability. In terms of size, again, this is going out into the taxable market rather than the tax-exempt market, different buyers. And they prefer larger transaction sizes to facilitate liquidity on their part. So if you're looking at transactions under $100 million, you probably will be paying a premium for those transactions. Amortizations, the taxable market has a preference for bullet maturities, but more traditional fully amortizing structures work as well, again, with a slight yield premium. Maturities can go out as far as 30 years, and in fact, the issuances we've seen to date do utilize the full 30-year maturity. Really, it results in better economics for the projects and for the issuances. Coupon types, again, a lot of flexibility. Current interest bonds, zero coupon bonds, convertible zero coupon bonds, a lot of flexibility around the structuring of this debt. In terms of callability, typically in the taxable market, again, they're looking for paper that is not callable, or if it is, with make-whole provisions. However, Build America bonds have been structured with more traditional muni call options, again, at a bit of a yield spread for those. And under the Act, Build America bonds can be refunded with more traditional tax-exempt debt. I'm going to kind of buzz through the next couple of slides, not to delve too deeply into the structuring. I know these slides will be available later, but suffice to say that for issuer subsidy bonds, which are the majority of them being issued at this point, where Treasury provides the 35% subsidy directly to the municipal issuer, the interest rate for purposes of rate covenants, et cetera, will need to factor in that subsidy. That's sort of the important issue there. And again, in terms on the next slide, tax considerations. Build America bonds can, again, really be issued only for purposes that are otherwise tax-exempt eligible, and you'll need your typical tax compliance certificates. Arbitrage yield, which is an important issue in tax-exempt issuances, applies here as well. The tricky part is, again, for issuer subsidy bonds, the interest rate is calculated at the applicable bond rate less the amount of this expected subsidy. For investor subsidy bonds, where the tax credit goes directly to the investor, interest is calculated at the bond rate. One of the keys on the next slide, really, again, as I said, one of the drivers for allowance for taxable bonds for municipal issuers was really to expand the investor base, which has lost significant market capacity, Karen referenced, over the past year. Issuers have, with these taxable issuances, been able to capitalize on their credit strength, the low default rates associated with municipal bonds in the taxable market. So investors are comparing them to corporate equivalent securities and have really viewed them, for the most part, as superior investments, given the quality of those investments. In this market that we're in today, a challenged market, the best candidates for issuance of Build America bonds are rated A or better issuers typically. And the appetite that we're seeing out there for Build America bonds, again, is being fed by domestic bond buyers who really have seen a dramatic drop in new issues for them to participate in, which has started to drive tightening of spreads, which is always beneficial. And these buyers who are purchasing these Build America bonds are mostly domestic corporate investors, bond funds, insurance companies, asset management companies, and the like. On the next slide, I note there that there have been about $10 billion worth of Build America bonds issued since February. So there's a pretty liquid market for them. I won't run through all of these. It's interesting, the Denver Water example, they had a $44 million 30-year Build America bond issuance. It was priced at 6%. So their effective rate that Denver Water will pay is 3.94%, about 4%. Their average interest rate for their tax-exempt bonds are 4.23%. So it's a good deal for both the issuer and the investor. On the next slide there have been some criticism of Build America bonds. I won't spend a lot of time on it. It has to do with tax rates, some of the yields that are being realized by investors in the secondary market. And I'll wrap up on Build America bonds by just saying that they don't particularly offer any particular advantages or unique structuring for performance contracting, but they certainly can be tied into performance contracting, building in a performance component with ESCOs, as you do with other tax-exempt structures we discussed earlier. I'd like to move just to talk a little bit about alternative contract structures, and I'll wrap up. These really are ways that state and local governments and ESCOs and other developers can utilize alternative contracting structures for performance contracting. And what we're really talking about are structures that call for private ownership of public sector projects, allowing developers, ESCOs, vendors to realize the full value of stimulus tax benefits, including depreciation, tax credits, and the like that would otherwise go unrealized and unleveraged. And we're talking about maximum leverage of the stimulus money in general that is out there for these types of projects. And for the public sector, this means utilizing funds for projects that need economic support. A lot of time, energy efficiency with longer terms and the ability to fully leverage don't necessarily require the investment of stimulus money, and that money is actually better leveraged for projects, particularly renewable energy projects, that have a harder time putting the economics together. And therefore, you can use that money for renewable energy where it's helpful and utilize these other contract structures that don't require funding or assumption of risk in performance contracting. And what we're really talking about are performance-based operating agreements for energy efficiency and potentially for renewable energy, shared savings, the old shared savings type structures that have been dusted off that we're utilizing now, energy services agreements, PPAs that allow really for off-balance sheet structuring, off-balance sheet treatment for both the end user, the public entity, and potentially for the vendor or ESCO who's participating in the transaction with your financial partner, taking ownership of the assets. So that allows for private ownership. It allows for off-balance sheet treatment. It allows for no upfront investment by the public sector entity. And some of the typical terms and conditions that you see apply to performance contracting. The vendor installs, operates, and maintains the equipment. The key here is that the end user is only paying for the particular commodity that is being generated, whether that's electricity or energy savings. And customers only pay for measured or realized savings or services that are actually delivered. Nothing is stipulated, or you would actually jeopardize your upfront payment. And the off-balance sheet would be generated. jeopardized if you use stipulated savings or pre-agreed savings. Contract terms on these range from 5 to 20 years. Environmental benefits can either stay with the vendor, stay with the owner of the assets, or go to the public entity. And because these are off-balance sheet type structures, contracts will typically contain end-of-term purchase or renewal options. And I'll go through one more slide here, I think, and sort of wrap it up. There are advantages to these for both the public and private sectors of using these off-balance sheet structures, essentially operating agreements versus balance sheet liabilities. It allows really the utilization of debt today for infrastructure matters more than ever, whether you're a public entity or a private entity. In particular, if you look at the proposed lease accounting rules that are under consideration, operating leases will appear on the balance sheet. So those aren't as strong of an option as they used to be. If they appear on the balance sheet, there's a risk that those obligations will ultimately affect ratings. So this really is a method for preserving existing debt ratings and debt capacity with sort of a no-risk opportunity for the public entity. They're contracts that are short and simple with minimum transaction costs. The vendor can share in commodity risk with the customers to some degree. You have vendors who are tied to long-term performance because that's how they're their payment is generated over the term. And again, it's unlimited return on it, on an investment, because essentially for the public entity, it's a zero investment. And even with a small share of savings coming back, that's potentially an unlimited return. And again, the private ownership allows for the utilization of all available local, state, and federal tax benefits, whether that's those depreciation, renewable energy credits, energy efficiency credits, other tax credits, can all be leveraged in these transactions because you do have private ownership. And I will, we're sort of out of time, so I will wrap it up there. These structures can be used as well for implementation of new technologies at the local level, and a couple of my slides talk about that. But since we're at the 2 o'clock hour, I will wrap up and just thank everybody for joining us, and thank everyone for the opportunity to speak today. If you would like additional information, information can be found on the ESE website, where I know this presentation will be posted as well. So thanks again, everybody.